On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Entrepreneur Steve Barr is on a mission to replace the worst public schools in Los Angeles with charter schools. He's got an army of supporters behind him, from union organizers to teachers to LA's mayor to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's got brass knuckles, and with 10 schools up and running, he's getting results. This hour, On Point, Steve Barr on fixing America's schools. In a moment, we'll hear from Steve Barr. But first, joining me from Los Angeles is Joel Rubin, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Joel, good to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Would you give us some background, start off here, on Green Dot Schools and Steve Barr?
Sure. Green Dot Public Schools is the largest charter school management operation here in Los Angeles. And just to step back even a little farther, charter schools are publicly funded schools, meaning they receive their funds from the state, just as traditional public schools do. But they operate outside of the typical restraints, both budgetary and instructional, that traditional schools operate under. So Steve Barr, several years ago, opened Green Dot Public Schools, and over those years has opened 10 relatively small schools. That's one of their tenets, is that they keep their enrollment low, and has made quite an impact on the educational landscape here in Los Angeles.
What kind of impact? How have the schools performed?
Well, two sort of separate questions. The impact for Steve Barr is as much macro-level political as it is instructional. He currently enrolls about 3,500 kids at his 10 schools, which when you compare that to the 700,000 kids that are enrolled in the Los Angeles Unified Public School System, you can see that his impact on how many kids he's enrolling is relatively small. But Steve has a vision that's much larger than what I think a typical charter school operator sees as their role. I think charter operators generally see themselves as small parts of a much larger movement. When you talk to Steve, I'm sure he'll mention that he doesn't necessarily want to even be in the charter school business. He'd much rather have sweeping brushstrokes as to defining what goes on in our traditional public schools. And he really sees his model as the answer for what all public schools should operate as.
And in the process of all this, there's been quite a rift that's been created within the Los Angeles Teachers Union itself. Can you tell us about that?
Well, vis-a-vis Green Dot, in the past few months, there has been quite a, well, whether past few months, past few years, one of Green Dot's greatest critics over the past years has been the leadership of United Teachers Los Angeles, which is the union that represents the roughly 45,000 teachers here in Los Angeles. In general, the union has been opposed to charters, mostly because charters are, in large part, unorganized. The teachers at the schools are not unionized. And understandably, the union has seen them as a threat to their traditionally sort of central role as power players in the district, and as the ones who drive the negotiations and the reform ideas in the district. So Green Dot is a little different in that, or significantly different in that, Steve Barr is very pro-labor and actually has a union that represents the teachers in his schools. So Green Dot has posed a unique conundrum for the union leaders here in L.A. Adding to the complexity is Steve is a very aggressive personality and has rubbed the union leadership quite raw over the years, and they've lashed out against him. In recent months, it's all come to a head as Steve has tried to take control of one of the city's most troubled, traditionally low-performing schools down in South L.A.
Locke High School.
It's really brought all these issues to a head. A few months ago, he announced and sent shockwaves to the district when he announced that his group had very quietly gathered the signatures of more than half of the tenured teachers at Locke. And what that did is set in motion this process by which, under state law, Green Dot was then entitled to petition the school district to take over Locke. and turn it into a series of small charter schools. Well, you can imagine that that just set off fireworks all over the district. Well, there are some of these so-called conversion charters in the district. This was something totally new, where an outside group and Green Dot at that, one that was generally reviled by many of the district leaders, is coming in and saying, "We're going to take over your school, and we're going to do it our way."
And so, where does that stand? What's going to happen?
Well, it's been quite a battle. So Steve and his group announced that they had gathered these critical signatures. The district leaders and union leaders went into sort of panic mode and descended on the school in the following days and weeks, and tried to convince the teachers that if they stayed within the district, that they could have a lot of the freedoms that come with charter schools. And in the days following, the district announced that several of the teachers had rescinded their signatures, and based on that, they threw out the petition that Green Dot had submitted. Well, in the meantime, several new members have been elected to the school board that seem to be more closely aligned with Steve and Green Dot's vision, and one of them has just announced that he will carry a resolution saying, no, we're going to vote on that initial set of signatures and this initial petition, and he's saying that he has the votes to get it through the school board and push this thing forward.
You've used the word aggressive to define Steve Barr. Obviously, there's been a lot of contention within the schools and the school district, teachers union, but he has had great success. I would ask, generally speaking, in Los Angeles, how is Steve Barr perceived? Is he considered a sort of savior of the L.A. public school system?
Really depends on who you ask. I think in general, and when we're talking about the real power brokers of the city, philanthropist Eli Broad, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the mayor, several of the school board members now, he is seen as somebody who, while perhaps a bit aggressive and somebody who people sometimes chafe against because he's very, he pushes very hard for what he wants, and doesn't like to take no for an answer. He still is somebody who is trying to find a new way to approach this idea of how do we educate low-income and minority students in Los Angeles. And he does, and I should say that he does have support of thousands of parents across the city, from the very rich neighborhoods to the very poor, through a what he's calling a parents' union that he helped start, which has really taken root and taken on a life of its own.
Joel Rubin is the education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Los Angeles. Joel, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Joining me now from New York is Steve Barr, founder and CEO of Green Dot Public Schools, which in 7 years started 10 charter high schools and has won approval to start 10 more. He's received funding from billionaire philanthropist Eli Broad and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And he's now trying to win control, as Joel Rubin just told us, of one of L.A.'s most troubled schools. He's mobilized parents, teachers' unions to help him. He is also co-founder of Rock the Vote. Steve Barr, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane.
So from your perspective, how are Green Dot schools different?
Well, in 1998-99, when I was trying to figure out what a great urban high school looks like, I spent a lot of time at some urban schools in Los Angeles. And what's happened in Los Angeles, to give you proper context, all the high schools in Los Angeles were built for 1,500 kids, but we didn't build a high school for 30 years. The only thing that happened over those 30 years is the population tripled. So now those schools, some of them have 3,000, 4,000, some of them have 5,000 kids, and they take the look more of a prison than in a high school. And so I spent some time at those schools, and I learned a lot of what not to do. I thought teachers were totally disrespected. They had very little say in what went in front of them. And how are they going to teach when you have virtually thousands of kids in front of you every day? And then I asked the question, well, what does $25,000 a year get you in Los Angeles? What do those schools look like? And I went to some of the tonier prep schools in Los Angeles. And for $25,000 a year, you would never send your kid to a school that had 5,000 kids or 4,000 kids. They'd probably have 300 or 400 or 500. Anyways, you don't want your kids to get lost to the cracks, and small schools are better for kids. And then also in those schools, you would never send your kid to a school if they had varied expectations based on skin color or shyness. No, you would have high expectations for all kids for $25,000 a year. And if my kid's behind, get him up to speed. That's what I'm paying you for. And then if I also spent $25,000 a year, I would never accept the idea that half the money you can't account for at any time. It's taken off the top for some huge bureaucracy. I would want all 25 grand of that money to get streamlined into the classroom to pay the best teachers and have the best tools to perform a perfect education or near perfect.
So is this really about getting getting money and injecting money into the system?
No. Well, of course it is. But it's also about, and the last part is, you know, I want some accountability and I want to be involved as a parent. And so those are some basic tenets that work for very rich kids. Why don't all, and we know that kind of works in some magnet schools and some successful charter schools. So our question is, why don't all schools in L.A., not that they have to be charters, which that's not the point of this, but why doesn't all schools have those basic tenets? And let's get past the, you know, the tribal, I'm a charter school operator, I'm in the union, I have this theory, vouchers, all those different things, which confuses people. But let's just go out with a real pure vision of a small, safe school with high expectations for all kids, where all the dollars get to the school site and parents are partners. And that plays really well in Boyle Heights in East L.A. and in South L.A., and it plays really well in Bel Air on the west side of Los Angeles. And that's what's been missing from the education debate, is just a clear vision of where we're going. What is the moonshot? What's the tangible thing that will change my community in a place where I can send my kid? And those basic tenets, that's what I try to focus on.
We're talking with the founder of Green Dot Public Schools, Steve Barr, about how he is transforming Los Angeles failing schools. In 7 years, he started 10 charter high schools and has won approval to start 10 more. Steve Barr, where do you get your money to fund these schools, and how much have you raised?
Well, the vast majority of the money comes from public funding. I mean, you know, when a kid comes to one of our schools, $7,000, $8,000 follows them. And it's a bit of a revolt. And that gets people's attention in a hurry when you lose money. I raise money somewhere between $1 million and $1.5 million per school, because we start with a ninth grade only. Mm-hmm. And then we add a ninth grade over 4 years, because we have to undo, in a lot of cases, 8 years of neglect and get kids up to the reading level and change the culture. So we don't actually break even until the fifth year of one of our schools. So, you know, in the first year, for example, in California, half, you know, you get your money based on your previous year's attendance. If you're a new school, you don't have a previous year's attendance. So you need money to pay teachers, and that's where the money comes from. I could stop growing today, and we are sustainable. I mean, I could stop, and we could stop at 10 schools, and that's quite a thing. But most people give us money because they want to see us expand.
Hmm. You've started Green Dot schools in some of the toughest, some of the poorest neighborhoods in Los Angeles. Give us a sense of your demographic. Who are your Green Dot students?
The vast majority of them are first-generation immigrants, which makes Los Angeles a spectacular place, and it also shows the hope. I mean, I've had to challenge my own preconditioned background and past as being a white American going into these communities. But, you know, first-generation Latino families, I've found, they're just as inspiring and made me think about my first generation and my family that came here and how special that is. And when you actually provide and nurture that first generation, these kids will work two or three times harder than all the other kids. And so we really, really draft off of their passion. And then the parents who risked everything to come to America, the new Americans, when you actually include them, and the first time you reach out and include them in a democratic way, they respond very positively. So there's some, that's what's going on in Los Angeles. And it also inspires the African-American parents in our schools. And those cultures feed off each other in a beautiful way in a small setting. And it also should be an inspiration for parents like me, white upper-middle-class parents who need to come back to the public schools as well.
I'm looking at some of the statistics. More than a third of your kids struggle to speak English. 84% are poor enough for subsidized meals at school. These are dangerous communities. I've read you've given money to parents whose kids have been killed by gang gunfire. So in the midst of all of this, what are the results that you're seeing with these kids?
Well, we go in areas where there's, you know, I'll take a step back. In Los Angeles, the high schools that, in the areas that we serve, have an average freshman class of about 1,500. And in those same high schools, they have about 500. And that's pretty consistent over years, which tells you we're losing 1,000 kids, you know, per class over time. And across the city, we're losing 30 to 40,000 kids. We go into those neighborhoods and we reverse that. And we graduate and retain 80 to 90% of the kids. They are college ready when they leave. And two-thirds or three-fourths of them so far in our graduation rates go to four-year colleges out of that. And they come in, it's not like we're getting some special kid either. They come in, half the kids read under the fourth grade reading level. Math is off the charts, they're not even close. And in that first year, the reason why I'm so protective about that ninth grade only at the beginning is we have to teach those kids to read and get them in the reading level the first year. And what's spectacular about that is that what happens to a 14-year-old kid who comes into our schools, who comes in slouching, looking down at their shoes when they walk by you, the light's barely on. And when they actually start getting that personal attention in a small school setting, and it's amazing. By Christmas, they start looking up, and by the end of the year, you're seeing a skip and a step and an eye contact because they've gotten help for the first time. And you know what happens to a 14-year-old kid who learns how to read for the first time? I mean, they become a world beater. And then the next 3 years gets a little bit easier doing college prep.
Are you, Steve, are you opening new school buildings? Are you actually moving on to existing campuses? I mean, I guess the question is, what is the process or the mechanism by which a school district actually relinquishes its facilities, where you actually go in and take over a public school?
Well, you know, over the 7 years when I think we've got really good results, the natural thing you would expect to happen is a school district would say, hey, you know, we've been failing in high schools for a long time. Why don't you come partner with us? And, well, that's kind of happened, but on their terms, and we can't guarantee results. And so when you have resistance to that, you've got to build political will to overcome that. Because in LA Unified, not unlike a lot of school districts, I'm in New York right now, you know, the grown-ups are very well organized, the people that work at school districts, and they should be. Teachers, the administrators, the all the different people that work at things. One group of people who are not organized and don't have a systematic change voice are parents. That's why I created a parents' union. And because, you know, PTAs are nice for intermittent, spot schools that support schools, but they're subsidized by school districts and by teachers' unions. And so what we've created in Los Angeles is across the city, different neighborhoods, different ethnicities, different economic levels, a singular voice saying, we want all our schools to be small, safe schools with high expectations where parents are partners and the dollars get there. And that's a very powerful message. And that's what it's going to take to get to the point where I'm not creating charter schools in churches in South L.A. outside the system, but we're actually working together to transform our schools for the greater good.
Steve Barr, hold on for just a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into this conversation. Joining me now from Los Angeles is A.J. Duffy, president of the United Teachers Los Angeles, which represents 40,000 teachers in L.A. Earlier this year, Duffy said that Barr, quote, takes bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, idealistic people and works them to death. A.J. Duffy, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Let me clear up a couple of things. One, the PTA in Los Angeles is not supported by the teachers' union, and Joe Rubin's interpretation that UTLA panicked when Steve got the teachers at Locke to sign on to Green Dot is not accurate.
I know this is a very contentious relationship between all parties, but I would like to ask you a couple of questions, Duffy, before we start. You've called Steve Barr an entrepreneur who's had, quote, success in selling his product, but I don't trust the product. Tell us why not.
Yeah, first thing is the debate has to be framed in honest statements. Joe Rubin's quote is a misquote, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and works them to death. What we have found is that in traditional charter schools, the teachers, who, unlike in Steve's schools, have very few rights. So they do work an 8 and sometimes 10-hour day. They do work on weekends because they're required to. And our view is, the protections that we have in our contract are not just there to protect teachers, they're to protect the profession, because anybody who's working 10 hours a day and on Saturdays is not going to become a professional teacher and last for 30 or 35 years, which is what we would like to have.
So I guess, Duffy, the follow-up question is, if Green Dot schools are a bad deal for teachers, then why are so many teachers moving to them?
I never said that. No, well, that's a newspaper reporter quoting to sell newspapers. I never said that.
Are teachers moving to Green Dot schools?
Some teachers are. The vast majority are not. But I think let's change the focus of the discussion. I think that Steve Barr and UTLA under new leadership since I came to office are converging on the same concept. And the concept is that the overblown bureaucracy at LAUSD is ineffective and can no longer do the job. A lot of the reforms that we have proposed and in some cases put into place within the district are exactly the same as Steve Barr's. We're talking about local control of schools, where teachers and parents and administrators make the decision, where they have the money that comes from the state, almost all goes to the school, where teachers and other professionals at the school site have absolute say over professional development and curriculum.
Okay.
So we're talking about the same thing.
Well, okay, fine. So I guess the bottom line is then, if the LA school district's dropout rate is 55%, over 70% of all high school students in LA score below a basic proficiency in level in math. So if Steve Barr is getting results, why wouldn't his plan be embraced? Why isn't his plan one good answer?
His plan is reform. So is UTLA's plan, reform. So we're talking about the same thing. And when you talk about dropout rates of 55%, I mean, even the people that put together the Harvard study from which these rates, these percentages are coming from, are telling everybody that they're reading them and misreading them wrong. But you know, whether you accept the Harvard study, the 50%, or what the district said, 24%, it's unacceptable, and we recognize that. UTLA has been fighting for years for the kinds of in-house local control reforms that Steve Barr has brought into place. He can do it because of the charter laws in California, and we are pushing to get the same kinds of reforms. And as I said, in one school in the Valley, we have it, and we're going to codify it, and we're going to go to the district. It's called the Expanded School-Based Management Model School. It's at a middle school,
yep.
And we believe that that the school board is gonna buy into it. And once that happens, the fire is lit, and there will be dozens of schools around the city that will want this model.
So if that's the model, then on some level, A.J. Duffy, did you make a mistake by not making some early arrangement to join Steve Barr and Green Dot in this effort moving forward, if this is indeed the future?
What we have said over and over again is we want what's best for the kids. That's one. And two, if the teachers at local schools, by a two-thirds majority, want a particular kind of reform, whether it's our expanded school-based management model or Green Dot or anything else, we will support what the local teachers want. When we say at UTLA we are about local control of schools, we mean it. And we put our money where our mouth is, and we don't just talk the talk. We walk the walk. And
A.J. Duffy.
Turns out that Locke High School, it becomes a Green Dot school, then we will work with the teachers.
A.J. Duffy joining us from Los Angeles. I appreciate your time, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Barr, to this issue of working with unions, A.J. Duffy represents, United Teachers in Los Angeles, 40,000 teachers. What's been your strategy as it relates to organized labor and teachers' unions?
Well, you know, we were the first charter group to start our own union, and because of the assessment I made it with the Teachers of Los Angeles was, are work conditions going to improve anytime soon? Are they getting a good deal? Why do 50% of them leave after the first-year teachers? We're not going to fix this problem with a profession that people, and I say this to the teachers all the time, and we all kind of laugh about it, but in a sad way, that, you know, when they go to cocktail parties with their friends and they say they're teaching, people go, oh, it's so great you're doing that. I couldn't do it. They should be asking, how do I get to do that? Because it's an awesome job, especially in the 20s. So how do you improve work conditions? And then how do you actually practice some union reform? Because frankly, the UTLA contract was written for a school system 30, 40 years ago when we just taught differently. And so it needs to be updated and refreshed and relevant. And that's not anti-union. And so, and in fact, I'm sitting here in New York City today. I will go with the president of the biggest teachers union in the world and present our joint charter for the South Bronx, a Green Dot UFT school. Because we are pro-union, and when we all start working together, and I think you got some of that in that discussion with Duffy, is we obviously agree on a lot of things. It's just posturing and egos and semantics at this point, because the more we argue and the more we fight on stuff we should be agreeing on, kids lose.
I guess the question that strikes me, Steve, is why is there such pushback? Why is there such contention if the goal is to help mostly underprivileged kids in the inner city school districts? Is it, you know, I keep hearing that there are personality issues and you are aggressive and there's contention and you're pushy and ambitious, and yet it seems you're getting results. What is the pushback? I mean, what is the core here?
Well, all that aggressive, pushy stuff, I mean, all I'm doing is channeling the desperation of parents. I mean, that's really what this is about. You have parents in the neighborhoods I serve who have no choices. The 50% of the people in that city, in the city of Los Angeles, who have no choices but the public schools, they are scared to death every day when their kids leave that they're not going to come home at night. They know they're getting a subpar education. They know they're being treated second class. And for years, there's been an apathy that's simmered and been simmering because there's been no hope. And when we've gone in these neighborhoods, we've sparked that hope. And what's also exciting in Los Angeles is that now there's a teacher revolt. So when, you know, I mean, imagine the idea that half of a tenured teachers of a failing high school would actually jump to a charter operator instead of their own union or reaching out to somebody else. What does that say? And then since that happened, several chapter chairs, which are the front line, you know, they're the union shop leaders of these schools, have come to me because they see the union and the district with too much of a closely defined relationship to create change. You know, when I went to Locke and met with teachers, and I didn't go to Locke unannounced or I threw a dart at a board and there's Locke High School, I'm going to take that thing over. It was from teachers reaching out to me saying, please help. We want to save our kids. We can't do it from within anymore. We need an aggressive push, and it's going to take a real jolt and a revolutionary approach to fix these schools.
And teachers feel like they have more freedoms with you. I mean, obviously, their union contract is not as solid, but Green Dot is highly decentralized then, right? So teachers can do more what they want to do. They have more freedom.
When you listen to teachers, you have a conversation, and everybody that listens to the show should have a conversation with a teacher. If you ask them what would make their jobs better, one would be the size of a school. You know, when a big school, whether it's a rich suburban school or a poor urban school, you just can't have that contact with kids when you have so many bodies in front of you in a given day. The only kids you'll get to know are the loud and the jocks and the, you know, the kids who misbehave or the brilliant. And so in a small school setting, they get to have that opportunity. You improve work conditions. The other thing is that drives teachers crazy is they in public schools in America, teachers have very little say in what goes in front of them. They have very little say in curriculum, textbooks, you know, and they're the product, but everything's made, all the decisions are made centrally, which really takes away a lot of the creativity and ownership by those teachers. So we implement that. And then we get every dollar in the classroom. We get 30% less money than LA Unified. I'm going to say that again, 30% less money than LA Unified, but we pay our teachers more.
But you get a lot of extra money subsidized from the outside from these philanthropic donations, too.
None of that. That's not the point of it. The point of it is that that doesn't subsidize our ADA, our budget from the schools. Mm. We do that because we only have 6% overhead, not 40 or 50% overhead.
Steve, I wanted to ask you, you've never worked as a principal, never been a teacher. And so I wonder where this passion comes from to make schools better.
Well, I'm a Californian, and, you know, on Saturday, I'm going to my 30th high school reunion in Cupertino, California, you know, and that was a special place. My mom moved us 7 blocks from San Jose schools to Cupertino schools, and so I could go to high school with the sons and daughters of Hewlett-Packard Engineers. And
she is a single mom, and your dad left when you were a baby?
Yeah, and I, a dental assistant and a waitress, and, you know, she had some rough times, and you know, I was a foster kid for a couple of years, and but we reunited, and she cared deeply about her kids, couldn't go to PTA meetings and, you know, couldn't be involved because she was working all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to that school, you know, we had a different sense of possibility in California. You know, I'm in the class of 1977. It was the last year of the fully loaded Pat Brown master plan of education system in California, where the idea was if you have the most educated people in the best K-12 system, you would bring high-end jobs. And that's the reason why there was a Silicon Valley where it is and the aerospace industry and the defense industry in Southern California, because you had the smartest people. It's not because engineers like to surf. You just had smart people there. Mm-hmm. And the next year we had a tax revolt, Prop 13, which led to a revolt across the country, which swept Ronald Reagan in the office. And the only thing that's happened since my 1977 is our schools have gone from the best to the worst in my adult lifetime. And what's passed as debate, and I've been involved in politics most of my adult life, is the left, which I'm a member of, saying we just need more money for failed centralized systems. Of course we need more money, but not for that system. And the right having indifference or privatize it, scrap it, or it's a teachers union's fault. And that's been what's passed as debate. And I thought, you know, at age, approaching age 40, having a pretty good midlife crisis, I had just buried my mom and my younger brother, and, you know, which makes you bolder or makes you retreat. And I decided to be bolder, and I wanted to create the Great American Urban High School. And I thought about teaching, and I thought about being a principal. But when I did a real assessment of the industry, of the profession, what was missing is the politics, not that people don't want to teach and people don't want there aren't great school leaders. It was the politics, and I thought I could apply my talents to that.
You mentioned your brother, Michael, who, as I read about you, you watched him sort of fall through the cracks in the public high school where you grew up. And I guess in a larger sense, you sort of see yourself in these inner city school kids, right? You see their faces, you see yourself.
Oh, I see them in most of these kids' eyes. My younger brother, you know, in this big high school, well-funded, you know, they used to tell us 20% of you are going to do really well and go to college, and 20% we can't do anything for. And the vast majority, as long as you can read or write, there's a manufacturing job base out there for you, so you can still be successful. But as our lives hit Cupertino High School, I was a good basketball player. We had a great basketball team. I became student body president. You know, that school was made for my personality. Mm-hmm. My younger brother was a little chubbier. His glasses never quite fit. He wasn't as outgoing. And I saw him get lost in that system, and his talents were never nurtured. And our lives took a separate path from that point on. Mm-hmm. And I never realized it until he passed that I thought, you know, what happened? Why did our lives end up so differently? Mm-hmm. And I'm not blaming that high school, but, man, he could have been nurtured. And so when I build these schools, I think very much about, you know, my younger brother and how he would have done in those schools.
Steve, I want to go to the phone lines. Listeners would like to join our conversation. Marlene is calling from Buffalo, New York. Marlene, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Mr. Barr. I think you have an outstanding idea, and I hope that your schools continue to flourish. And I'd like to say, if you could come to Buffalo, please do. I am a big fan of Jonathan Kozol. You mentioned the South Bronx. The school systems there are horrific, according to Jonathan Kozol. And I really think that, unfortunately, the idea that you have, which is wonderful, and I know it works because it works in the schools that you mentioned, the reason why it doesn't work where there are poor people and people of darker complexions is due to the fact that the country is such a racist country that they're not really concerned about getting everybody up to standards and making everybody be the best they could be. That is only restricted oftentimes to those who have money and the affluent people of the United States.
Marlene, I'm going to thank you for your call. Let me turn to Steve and ask you something. Marlene says, come to Buffalo. What's the end game for you here? Do you want to open these charter schools across the country? I mean, what's your vision sort of in years to come?
I don't want to open charter schools across the country because that's not going to change the system. What's going to change the system is for Marlene in Buffalo to create a parent uprising to demand that her school, all the schools in Buffalo, have these basic tenets, and it's a very tangible thing to sell door to door. And if everybody in Buffalo demanded their schools look like that, meaning you take all the dollars, you put it at school sites, make truly the schools truly part of the community, and that they actually serve the parents, not the grown-ups who work at the system, a lot of new people and a lot of existing people will follow that vision. We're not going to solve this with a bunch of charter schools. It's not about, you know, Steve Barr coming to Buffalo. It's about people be inspired by the story and creating their own uprisings and fighting for this thing. And guess what? It can happen very quickly because people are starved for this kind of hope. It's very tangible. And education is a great equalizer. And, you know, and the reason why these philanthropists give me money, it's not because they're altruistic, nice people. They are altruistic, nice people, by the way. But their bottom line's being affected. You know, I get a lot of attention from Silicon Valley. The reason why is because people aren't buying that third, instead of that third television, not buying a computer, or we have to import labor. You know, we need to be smarter and quicker, and we need and the education system is killing our economy. I mean, you hear this from people nationally, and we wring our hands and we go, geez, I guess there's nothing we can do about it. It's going to take an uprising in every community in this country, and not just in the poor areas. You know, I live in Silver Lake in Los Angeles, and the Parents Union chapter there has no Green Dot schools there, and my neighbor, who's a $500 an hour litigator, you know, she heads this thing up, and she just wants all schools to have these basic tenets, and they're entitled parents, and we can barely afford our mortgages, and we went to great public schools, and we're rising up and saying, you know what, I'm not going to change my life to go to private schools. I'm paying taxes, so I want to fix my public schools, and that's what this is about.
I want to go back to the phones from Bakersfield, California. Laura is on the line. Laura, hello to you.
Hello. I have a question for Mr. Barr and then a comment.
Sure.
I'm a teacher in a public high school in Bakersfield, California, and we have to give the California standards test every April. Does his charter school have to give those tests?
Absolutely.
Good question, Laura. Thank you.
Absolutely. I mean, we are a – listen, this fight against accountability is – I get it. We're not test-driven crazy, but we do have to find data that tells us that when I look at a parent's face that we are doing the right thing. For example, we have an, you know, if a ninth grade math teacher scores are not doing well, there's only one ninth grade math teacher. So the one way we can do that is we need to provide more resources and more development for that teacher. Or at some point, if it's not working, we have to find another teacher because we don't work for the teachers. We work for those families. And so we are very data-driven, not obsessed. The only data I really care about is how many of our kids do the impossible in these neighborhoods where only 4% of them may graduate from college and actually go to college, get that degree, and come back and change that community. Because it's not going to, those neighborhoods aren't going to change by some white liberal with good intentions. It's going to be an army of people coming back with a college diploma, which means we'll make $1 million more of our lifetime and demand a better community.
Steve, let me bring in Chad Saleo, also in New York City. He's principal of Animo Pat Brown High School, which opened in the fall of 2006 in Los Angeles. Chad, hello to you.
Hi, Jane.
I'd like to know from your perspective as a principal of one of these Green Dot schools, what's it like to work there?
It's great. You know, I used to work at Locke High School, both as a as an English teacher and as an assistant principal. And coming over to Green Dot and working within the Jefferson community where we are in South LA has been just a really empowering experience, not only for me but for our teachers and for the parents and students that we're working with.
And how do you see students responding to this new approach? Smaller classrooms, school is open later, a different way of teaching students themselves.
They're doing well. We mean we certainly have our students who are a handful, you know, and the difference here is that I know them and, you know, as opposed to a principal of a school with, like Steve was saying earlier, 3,000 to 5,000 students. I know them. I know their parents. The teachers know them, and we're relentless in moving these students forward from where they are.
Are parents more involved than they have been at the other LA public school where you taught?
Definitely.
And how did you create that involvement?
You know, we invited them. That's a big first step that I didn't see happening very much at Locke. You know. In larger schools, they have general forums for parent involvement, like a back to school night early in the semester, or something along those lines. You know, we're calling parents constantly. Students who are late to school are getting phone calls within the first hour. I have cell phone numbers, work numbers, all kinds of contact information for each parent. We do have similar type forums where we have back to school nights, but we also have kind of an open door policy where parents are coming in, speaking to teachers, working with students after school and involving themselves in our school.
And when you hear some of the union representatives, union organizers, a lot of them have problems with this new system and the Green Dot plan. What's your response to that as a teacher, as a principal, as an administrator in the thick of it?
Well, I take a similar line that Steve does, in that, you know, the teachers' union is protecting teachers' interests. You know, I'm more interested in protecting the students' interests at this point. So, and I think sometimes, unfortunately, the two are mutually exclusive. You know, especially at some of the lowest performing schools in Los Angeles, like Locke High School. Mm.
Let me go back to the phones. Chad, thank you. Doug is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Doug, hello to you.
Hey, how are you, Jane?
Fine, thank you.
Listen, I'm a school psychologist, and I hear a bunch of people who have a lot of similar intentions. I support unions. And my question to you is, how are you going to guard against what I consider to be the real interference in centralized education? And I don't necessarily think centralizing education is all that bad, but the real interference is once these systems get entrenched, they hide behind attorney advice, they hide behind the Sixth Amendment rights. And what that does is it stops transparency and it stops the inspiration coming from where the rubber meets the road. So how is your program, your set of charter schools, how are you going to guard against becoming entrenched and hiding behind attorney advice, which often is a lie? Because basically the unions try, they're not looking after teacher interests so much, I believe, as supporting teacher inspiration.
Okay, Doug, thank you. Steve?
Well, we're very transparent. I mean, every parent and every teacher and every student has my home number and my cell number, and I know the schools do well when I don't get a lot of calls. But they have total and complete accountability. And so, in fact, my best moments of my week are, when we have a problem at a school and going and sitting down with teachers and parents and talking about it. The day we did, we had an announcement 2 weeks ago of $8 million from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and that was spectacular, and it was a great endorsement of our product. But that evening, I spent 4 hours with parents in our South LA school because we made a leadership change because I thought that the school was okay, but it didn't meet my standards, which is a school I want to send my own daughter to. And the parents asked me, would you send your kid to the school now? And I said, no, I wouldn't, but I will next year, and we're going to fix it together. And that, to me, was more fun than anything else I do, you know. And so, because it's getting to meet the people that we actually spend time with, and I spend a lot of time with parents.
Steve, realistically.
Not a lot of time with lawyers, thank God.
Realistically, Steve, where would your schools be without, these billionaire philanthropists? And how dependent are you long-term on their donations?
You know, like I said before, we're sustainable right now. I only get money from people that want to see us expand.
But as you expand and get bigger and these programs go to other cities.
Well, we're not going to other cities. I mean, we're going to one city, which is New York. We are flirting with the idea of an affiliate model where I will only go to a city potentially that partners with a teachers union or an SCIU, for example. Because I think that's worthwhile. I'm in New York and Randy Weingarten is this amazing union president who sees things differently and sees things a third way. I wouldn't have come to New York if the mayor or the chancellor had asked me to come here because I've turned a lot of mayors and chancellors down. Mm. But I think it's game-breaking. I think it's a game-changing experience when you get the teachers combined with the reformers and the business community and the parents all coming together to solve this problem. And that's worth getting on a plane a few times a year and doing it. Mm. So I've opened that, it drives everybody crazy in Los Angeles because Locke High School is the game now. If we can take our model and transform a school in the middle of Watts surrounded by four of the biggest housing projects in the country, the home of the ground zero of the gang problem in Los Angeles and probably the country, a place where 1,300 kids start as freshmen and 500 are there at sophomore. So we lose 800 kids every year from that school. And we turn that thing around, it'll spark a revolution across Los Angeles.
What do you think of your chances? What are your chances?
It's going to happen. It's absolutely going to happen. I have 10 charter schools in hand. The new school board's bringing it up. The new school board, which actually was financed and led by our mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, there's a sense of urgency there that can't be stopped now.
All your schools, Steve, all the Green Dot schools carry the name Animo at the head of them. And I'd like you to tell us as we go out here what that means.
So when I started the first school, the working title was Leadership High School. The first community was Lenox, which was 98% first generation, right under the flight pattern at LAX. And I asked the Chicano Studies Department at Loyola Marymount University to help me with a name. And they went away like good academics, and they did focus groups and they came back a month later, and they were all nervous, and they gave me 11 names, and 10 of them were horrible in acronyms. And then there was a throwaway 9, Animo. So I called a friend of mine in Puerto Escondido, Oaxaca, I used to surf with, and I said, he was a teacher, I said, Alberto, what does Animo mean? And his English is as good as my Spanish, and he said, it means get off your ass. And so these kids love the fact that they go to Get Off Your Ass High School.
I thought it meant something about having spirit, but
well, that's,
thank that,
well,
you that, anyway.
No, no, well, that's obviously the but I like that okay. The other interpretation better.
Well, Steve Barr, founder and CEO of Green Dot Public Schools, thanks for joining us. And Chad Saleo, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.